This is Seeking Delphi, episode number 31, Ethically Aligned Design in Autonomous Systems. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. When it comes to the ethics of disruptive technologies like automation and artificial intelligence, one could easily say, with apologies to Mark Twain, that everyone talks about it, but nobody does anything. But one organization is doing something. IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, has recently issued a 290-page book of guidelines for autonomous systems, entitled Ethically Aligned Design, A Vision for Prioritizing Human Well-Being with Autonomous and Intelligent Systems. It's the work of hundreds of contributors under the auspices of IEEE's Global Initiative on Ethics of Autonomous and Intelligent Systems. John C. Havens is the executive director of the initiative. He's previously been on Seeking Delphi to discuss Emotion AI and his book, Artificial Intelligence. I spoke to him again recently to learn more about the latest IEEE work. John, welcome back to Seeking Delphi. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. Really appreciate you having me back.
So you were previously on this podcast about a year and a half ago to talk about your book, Artificial Intelligence and the Ethics, Potential Ethical Issues in Autonomous Systems, Artificial Intelligence, Robotics, whatever. But in the meantime, you've been working in a formal sense with IEEE to come out with what's now their Ethically Aligned Design First edition, a 290-page book. So tell us about the evolution, a little bit about the evolution and the purpose of this publication.
Sure, and thank you for asking. And as you kind of inferred there, just so I'll make it clear, so I'm speaking as John, not as a formal, meaning these are my views and opinions, they are not necessarily formal, reflections of IEEE. And mainly say that because both technically I'm a consultant with IEEE, and also the nature of IEEE is it's an awesomely huge organization where there's a lot of different views and opinions. So all that to say, formal opinions or position statements from IEEE come from the board. I'm speaking as John. So yeah, my role, however, which is full-time, which is love doing, is I'm the executive director of a program called the IEEE Global Initiative on Ethics of Autonomous and Intelligent Systems. And the volunteers, there's now about 2,000 people who are members, but the more, let's say, active volunteers, 400 or 500 people who have helped write what is now, it's kind of the third version, but we're calling it the first edition because the first two versions were also requests for inputs and sort of drafts in one sense. But the 400 or 500 people who wrote it are global in nature. It was mainly North American and Europeans, but there are over 50 people from China, South Korea, and Japan. We have a smaller amount of members from places like Brazil, Africa, and Australia, New Zealand, and I'm very proud of it. It came out, it's a free Creative Commons document, and the first edition came out about 3 weeks ago.
Clearly, with 290 pages, there's a lot in here, but can you give us like a general overview? I know there's some overall guidelines that are enumerated, that are outlined, and maybe you could talk about those before we try to get into some specific examples.
Sure. There is a general principles section, and like so much great work that's happening in the world these days, like the European High-Level Experts Group latest version of their paper that came out, which is just fantastic. And Raja Satila, who's our chair, is one of the members of that group. We have two other people on our executive committee, the amazing Francesco Rossi, and also the amazing Virginia Dignam. Raja is also amazing. Forgot to say that. But all three of them are fantastic. They're also three of the people on that group. In our case, some of the general principles that open up the general principles chapter, the first one is human rights. And that one is one that makes us unique from other documents. And I want to be clear, too, there's been some conversations about this type of stuff on Twitter. It's very important to not say, in my opinion, that one set of principles or documents or whatever is better than someone else's. Because better is, A, is somewhat irrelevant. B, especially in terms of ethics, a lot of the work is to be much more clear and say why a certain type of thinking comes from a certain perspective and leave any sort of moral or bias-based judgments off of it. That said, I do think it's also important to talk about when there are similarities between different principles, what they are. And for instance, one that is a deeply aligned and similar kind of basis for our principles and something like the high-level expert group is that it's human-centric. Human-centric has different definitions, but technically it's things like having human in the loop mindset, which is that at least for many in verticals and uses of these technologies, there has to be the ability for a human to intercess in something and either shut something down or be able to have a ongoing, not intervention, because that always makes it sound negative, but more of a sense of human in the loop, like how do humans help train data or avoid bias? Anyway, I bring that up because human rights being so fundamental in global work with legal aspects, human rights is law. And it can be very difficult to interpret in different regions or different applications. But the reason we put it first, and by the way, I should say we, meaning these eight principles, or maybe, I think it's eight in this version. But all the general principles were also voted on by the General Principles Committee. And there were about 30 people in the committee. But also the logic is that all those principles from all the other chapters, the nine other chapters, those committees would say, hey, for the list that was in version two of ethically aligned design, we align with those, or also here's a principle that needs to be added. Anyway, so human rights is the first. It also makes things a little bit easier in one sense, meaning that if you're going to build something and you knowingly know that it might violate human rights, then that's certainly a good time to pause and say, is this something, I guess, fundamentally that we want to build? Or secondly, why would people interpret that this is going to violate human rights? And this becomes the opportunity for clarity, for building trust. And also what's really challenging is how human rights is interpreted around the world. But you have to have those conversations and know that what you're building is going to affect humans and their rights. And a core of what we believe with the initiative is that all of these things, or as a lot of it at least, needs to be discussed before you even start blueprinting, because it's not the time to ask these questions once you've built something. You have to ask that these questions at that time as well. But if you don't ask the fundamental questions at the front end of design, then you may build things with bias or without the considerations that would actually change what you built, even for the time that it's going to be used for testing.
Can I interject something here, John?
Yeah, please do.
That would be in terms of human rights. You mentioned Chinese. Now, obviously, human rights are viewed differently in China than in the West. And I'm wondering if that was there any conflict there in reaching these guidelines in that regard?
The short answer is yes. You know, and I think it's easy. Again, this is me speaking, Miss John, also not for the whole of the initiative, but it's easy to pick any particular country in a certain context and say that country has human rights violations. I'm not a human rights lawyer. It is not my expertise. But from my understanding, you can point to any country, and depending on the timing, you can say that country, you know, broke these human rights violations. In the States, certainly there's issues that the States is struggling with. Where, yes, it was a challenge because even framing something as human rights, also, sometimes people can say, this is outside of China, by the way, that phrase can seem somewhat Western. Human rights, one thing, we have a chapter called the Classical Ethics in Autonomous and Intelligent Systems chapter, which I really love. And it points out when we had our first version of our paper, Ethically Aligned Design, we got a lot of feedback saying this feels quite Western. And that's how we actually found a lot of our Chinese and South Korean and Japanese members was they said this feels Western in sort of meaning Western ethical traditions, which is quite Greek and focused on the individual versus more Eastern traditions and also Global South can be more communal focused. And even that paradigmic level understanding for me, I speak for myself. And again, it's different than the human rights conversation because that's not my expertise, but from a perspective standpoint, we hope that helps to say any particular current human rights issue in any country that one, a reader of the document would say, well, that's a concern. great. Meaning if you feel something's a concern, then that's going to help you as you build something or communicate about these issues. But be aware the same people that you're concerned about may come back and say, well, what about the human rights issues where you live? And those conversations, if they can be done, hopefully, in ways that aren't first and foremost judgmental, which is really hard. And by the way, I don't mean saying, depending on the human rights, quote, violation, they may be horrible, whatever they are. So I'm not saying that you would be accepting of the violations. What I'm saying is that if the conversations can't even happen because a person is judging with their perspective and their bias without even understanding that paradigm level difference, well, I'm from the West, that person's from the East, and that frames how we're even going to approach all of our life, let alone this particular issue. For me, at least, that chapter was incredibly helpful to say, I'm going to try to at least approach things, asking more questions and trying to learn, and also asking the questions from people who live there, who work there, who create policy, to try to have a basis for creating things that will increase overall human well-being.
All right, to go back now to the global guidelines, let's continue.
Sure, and thank you because you're letting me be chatty, which I appreciate, Mark, but it's a good conversation. Two other principles I'll mention, which are the first three, and I may be getting the order wrong, but one is called data agency. And data agency versus the term privacy, we think is critical. I'm co-chair of the chapter focused on data agency with the amazing Katrina Dow, who is the co-chair. She's just brilliant in the space of personal data and identity issues. But privacy, you know, protecting a person's privacy, however that's defined in whatever country. Nowadays, especially with the EU's GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, means that now companies have to follow certain processes to obey EU law. And if they break it, then they can be fined, etc. Well, that in the past couple of years has been a reason why a lot of users in America and around the world now click new types of privacy statements when they go to a website. And what I think is so incredible about that is it's the first time since I've been in the personal data space for about 7 years that anybody, I'm sure Mark, for you, like friends who aren't in this space, would have been like, why am I clicking all these things? What's the deal? Well, that means there's a new level of communication and care that companies are now putting towards data, especially for European citizens, because that's what it's geared towards. However, what the other aspect of the privacy conversation that needs to happen, and these are questions also government and surveillance and all that type of stuff for advertising, you know, tracking issues that can all be, by the way, positive, right? I don't mean to use either of those terms, surveillance or tracking, in a pejorative sense. I mean surveillance, governments in airports, you know, things where we are being kept safe and where we want to opt into having advertising algorithms track our purchases so that we can have personalized recommendations. All that said, in short, the idea of being tracked from the outside in, whereas individuals, what that means is we click consent agreements, where I'm using air quotes for consent, air quotes being because we kind of don't know all of what we're consenting to, and reading a 40-page document saying, here's what you're consenting to, then just it really in one sense means everybody understands that people aren't really reading it. And while it's easy to say, well, you shouldn't click on something or sign something that you haven't read or fully understand or agreed to, we're at the point now where that doesn't really make sense to not participate on a Facebook or a Google or any of the platforms that people enjoy. To sort of say like, and I'm not inferring or any way that people are being tricked. I'm just saying that like, to tell people sort of like, well, this button is something you do, but we kind of, everyone knows you're not really reading it and stuff. That just means that there's not clarity, there's not trust. Whereas data agency is this idea of putting people at the center of their data. And putting people at the center of their data means that using something that's tied to an identity marker, and that just means you can prove your Mark and I can prove I'm John. Then you have what we call personalized terms and conditions. And we actually, there's a standard working group that was inspired by ethically aligned design that Doc Searls, who is one of my heroes, wrote The Intention Economy and has this idea of kind of reversing sort of how the market works in one sense, where if, when you project your terms and conditions, it now to the world algorithmically, it's sort of like saying, okay, I know for these great services I want to use, I have to click your consent stuff. Well, if you want access to my data, you also have to accept my terms and conditions. And if it starts to be at an algorithmic level, the reason you're put back at the center of your data is there's this whole ecosystem around what's called sovereign data or things like smart contracts, using blockchain type tools, where you can exchange a small amount of data for a certain amount of time and really have, in one sense, more control over your identity. You can still also be tracked. You will always be tracked from the outside in, but where you have the sort of sense of being able to have your own terms and conditions, then you're more, there's this parity where you get to say, well, this is what I want. This is what you want. Now we can discuss together what that means.
I do have a question for you in that regard, in terms of that negotiation, because of course I just completed an interview with Kari Wolcott from Intel Ambient Science, where she talked about the potential negotiation in the system of with digital twins. And I wonder if that's something down the road that has been addressed.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you mentioned digital twin. There's another standards working group that Katrina is actually chairing called IEEE P7006 is the name. And it's focused on creating, the term there is more of an AI agent. Twin, I think that's probably the same thing that you're talking about, and tell me if I'm wrong, but where you're sort of creating a protection in one sense for your identity at an algorithmic level is, in one sense, you're creating, if not a twin or a doppelganger, a sense of like, well, I'm John Havens. If I know what my terms and conditions are, I can keep kind of an always on algorithm that can project, broadcast, as it were, my terms and conditions. That, in one sense, is a twin, as it reflects my, you know, views and values about data sharing. How the AI agent model that we're trying to build in 7006 takes that sort of a step further is to say, well, cool, now you've got that reflection of who you are, the protections of it. The word agent almost could be a number of things, like a lawyer actually protecting you. The agent also would know, like, representing your best interests with the stuff you want to buy. But it really just means essentially a parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, a parity of the same way there's all these amazing, you know, technologies that can know all these nuances of our actions and that has insights about who we are, our values, our personality, our identity. Those same tools, the logic here is to let those be more easily available and understandable to the general public. And then that, I'm assuming maybe this is the case with Intel as well, that twin of yours is essentially an actor who is working on your behalf first and foremost, so that when the thousands of algorithms that track you, you have a more always-on version, as it were, of aspects of who you are to handle things, so you could get like texted or something or emailed, hey, X number of algorithms today did not honor your terms and conditions, so they were thwarted or turned off, or you may want to examine. It's sort of the logic, like Mozilla has done great work in this space, like with ad blockers, or that's kind of how I think it's going to look to people. We're going to get some kind of announcements or emails, be aware of X, and then you'll just change your preferences or not work with certain brands, for instance, if they don't dedicate or they don't give you the same trust that you're trying to give to them. That all makes sense.
It does. So you had a third one of the overall guidelines you wanted to talk about. So which one was that?
Oh, thank you. That's well-being, which is something that's close to my heart. My last two books focus on this. The subtitle of the entire paper since the first version is A Vision for Prioritizing Human Well-Being with Autonomous and Intelligent Systems. A couple things about the word well-being. Usually people think that it can be synonymous like with happiness or mood, which is understandable. But in the economic well-being world, and this is with places like the OECD and the EU, or the United Nations with their World Happiness Reports, well-being in the actual like world of positive psychology and these economic indicator worlds is actually synonymous more with a word like flourishing. And we use that word, the Greek version of the word, or vice versa. Eudaimonia is the Greek word that the English version is flourishing. And the other term is life satisfaction. So I'm just bringing this down because when you have a term in measurements for something about both mental and physical actual health, meaning that's the well-being term we're used to, and you can say, are the autonomous and intelligent systems we're building, can they provably both align with and increase positive human well-being? Then the logic is what I'm building going to increase mental and or physical health? And if not, that is a warning sign. Oh, this could harm mental health, for instance. So that is sort of a line in the sand saying, is the stuff that you're building going to increase overall well-being? And then when you realize that the terms like life satisfaction or flourishing in the economic realm also mean things like with the OECD, there's multiple indicators that go beyond just fiscal indicators of productivity or wealth, where those are important things to measure. But if they're the only things that we measure, then, for instance, the environment is ignored or mental health is ignored. So when we can say is what we're building, not only promoting physical and mental health, but is also promoting for a human to have well-being. This is understandably, sometimes people have said, well, why don't you also include environmental well-being in the subtitle? And the answer is A, it's already a long subtitle, and B, for humans to flourish, the logic is not just that the environment is protected enough so that we don't die. That's a given. But it's also something where environmental sustainability, the environment has to actually flourish, not just survive, or humans also won't survive. It can sound anthropocentric, meaning humans are being put above the environment. That was never the intention, but understand if people think that. But well-being, the logic of it being a principle is when the community, a lot of times in the community, you'll hear the phrase, or anywhere, you'll hear the phrase AI for good. First of all, in one sense, awesome. That generally means things like, how can we use these amazing technologies to cure cancer, to avoid bias? And I'm completely down with that. Yes. But when you say to especially a room full of ethicists and philosophers and a lot of this, the members who wrote this paper, that's their actual work, saying AI for good is about as vague as you could be. Like, what good? Who's good? What are you talking about? What's the context? Where are we? Versus saying, when you build something, does it provably increase human well-being and environmental sustainability? This is now where you can start to have metrics like, well, health is something like a measurement in a lot of census data, which is an objective metric for well-being, is life, number of years lived. And that's one metric for, all right, if people live longer, then they must be healthier. And whether or not a person agrees on that or not as a metric, the point is that is a metric used. A subjective well-being indicator is a survey, meaning you ask a citizen, are you satisfied? What's your life satisfaction about living in Denver, Colorado, or Beijing, China, or Norway? There, a citizen is saying, well, this is my reflection of my experience, and where life satisfaction is not just GDP-oriented money stuff, but also, do you have access to education? Do you have access to, you know, clean environment? Then when a citizen gives a score, like on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, if they say their life satisfaction is 3, then that means that's a red flag. What? And then you can ask them, is your mental health, what, you know, what's the issue? That gives you something to work with. If it's very high, then you can also ask the government or whoever, say, that's encouraging. We think like we're doing good stuff. So all that to say is, especially those three things together, and by the way, I'm not minimizing the rest of the principles, things like accountability, transparency, et cetera. But those three things do make our principles and our document unique, because Human Rights Data Agency and the increase of well-being as a definitive way to say what we are building is increasing societal, positive societal and human flourishing. Those things we feel are unique and hopefully helpful for anyone who reads them.
So we see a lot on human rights, human well-being. Let's get a little bit more out there. You, as the author of Artificial Intelligence, have talked about emotion AI, and with that ultimately comes the potential for creating perhaps machines that deserve their own rights. Is that something that's been addressed, to the potential advent of a conscious machine, or is that kind of still too far out there to be looked at in this current initiative?
Sure. There's the law section. I'm not objective at all. So let me just, for listing my bias, you'll hear me sort of say like, oh, another one of my favorite chapters, because they're all sort of my favorites, because it's, you know, when you have the baby, as it were, but also the volunteers and all these groups, I know them personally, right? So the law chapter of Ethically Aligned Design, first edition, Nico Economou, who's one of the co-chairs, along with John, who's the committee co-chair, his last name will come to me in a sec. Anyway, their committee is fantastic, and their section is about 40 pages long. The second part of their section focuses on this idea of, it's different terms from a legal standpoint, usually robotic personhood. So there's a lot of the legal side in there. Effective computing focuses on the field of emotion AI, as you talked about it, which is the study of affect. A few things are the way you even asked your question, and I may not get all the exact words right, but they certainly, how you asked it, right, I think he said something like, ask machines get more emotionally savvy or something to that degree. What you'll read in the paper, which I also agree with, is, and again, this is me, John, saying this, but also from a scientific standpoint, at least right now today, the machines are not emotional. The machines reflect their output is something that we interpret as having emotional aspects. So in one sense, everything is being anthropomorphized. A machine saying, I love you, Mark, or I love you, John, can make you and I feel emotional. The logic of, is the machine itself demonstrating from its own consciousness or its own sense of innate being, as it were, emotion, at least the empirical science side of it. And now I'm speaking for, you know, many, many members of the initiative and a lot of the scientific community, at least today, is the machine itself is not emotional. This is not to judge, by the way, if you read the classical ethics section, there's the Shinto tradition in Japan that does imbue it says it better in the chapter, but a sort of spiritual aspect to objects or artifacts that are created by people. And also, if someone wants to believe, meaning it's their faith-oriented perspective, that a machine right now today is real, I'm not here to judge them. But the reason the language is so critical is right now today, if you build something and say, this companion robot is emotional and it can help you with your emotions, the people at least building it, there's a sense of disclosure where not intentionally and not in any way probably to cause harm, of course, but someone creating that companion robot, a lot of the disclosure aspect and the effective computing chapter talks about this is critical. Where the disclosure is, and you want to say it in a way that doesn't sound too geeky or turn people off or minimize the benefits of the machine or system, but it's to say, look, and all the things I'm going to say right now would have to be said in a soundbitey way and in a much more clear buyer or user-friendly way. But is this companion robot, what it actually is an amazing android, meaning it's a robotic device. It may have a morphology, meaning it's made to look like either a person, or it might be made to look like a small, cute thing. Either way in the design, and this is all of human-computer interaction, the designers know, or at least they should, that it's particularly because of how they make that device look and act, as it were, meaning its code. And when I say act, I mean the actions or manifestations of what it does. Those are designed to, when they interact with humans, knowingly beforehand, elicit certain things. So when you have a robot that might look, quote, too much like a human, I know you know this term, of course, is the uncanny valley, where you're like, I know it's not a person, but it's made to look enough like a person, it's kind of freaking me out. Well, that level of discomfort, which is called the uncanny valley, it's not that it's good or bad, it just is. It's just, you know, especially the first couple times a person interacts with that android, that will be there. Does that mean it will stay? Not necessarily. Does it mean if the person's first interaction with that device can be mitigated by disclosure, and you can even tell them, hey, be aware that when humans first interact with this, you might have this kind of weird feeling. Well, then why wouldn't you disclose? That's only going to build trust. More importantly, with things like elderly or with kids, where something is presented as being emotional, that is, I'm quoting here now from the effective computing chapter. Well, not quoting, but this is what's in there. There's a very fine line between what's called nudging, robotic nudging, which is something that you want, which, for instance, even something like a Fitbit provides a form of nudging where you're buying it because you want to watch your weight or exercise. So you get a reminder, hey, you haven't run yet today, or you haven't taken all your steps. That might irritate you, but you're in on it, right? There's disclosure and data and all that. You said, I'll share this data. You're in on it. Manipulation happens when, say, a companion robot, even if it's with a loving intent, is put in the midst of, say, an elderly person, and they just sort of say like, oh, this is a cute looking robot, made to look like a dog or something, and they start interacting with it. But it uses voice analysis, or it can speak back. And there's already a lot of data showing that bad actors are, you know, elderly are very easy, sadly, sometimes to steal from. So the device can very easily manipulate emotionally someone and then have them do something. Hey, maybe you should donate money to this, whatever. Am I saying that's what all of AI creators are intending? Not at all. Of course not. But this is where right now today, this absolute specificity of saying, The robots and devices today are not inherently emotional. They are built with code. They are built with sensors to measure our facial expressions, our micro-expression. That level of disclosure is what's critical. And the conversation about consciousness is a longer one, but I've already answered really long so far, where it's in some ways a distraction if the rights, and I will say this because human rights being the first principle, where robotic personhood and rights, the clarity is about things like liability and those things, those are really important. But I think then the conversation should be changed to something like device liability concerns, where the word robot rights, meaning that device over there, will it have the same or similar rights to a human someday, is not only a distraction, and now I'm speaking just as John, is also frankly kind of an offense to who humans are today, because we're women, people of color, LGBT community, whoever it is, the rights immigrants around the world are in such, there's so much trepidation about the actual rights of the humans that are here now. That to say, well, we also want to be considerate of who or what may come. I applaud in one sense the empathy, but it's a big distraction, A, from the rights that still aren't being handled now. And it's very, very, very easy for someone who is building a device to fight for, quote, robot rights, where really, because there's a lack of clarity, what they're also interested in is the intellectual property of what they're building. So they may be looking for more rights to protect their intellectual property and have more covering, as it were, for things like tax issues, et cetera. And by the way, I don't think there's anything wrong with them fighting for those things, but not under the umbrella of, I really want rights for this device because I believe that it's conscious. If you do, then at least for me, John, again, I'm speaking just as John here. If that's what you want, then disengage your device from being tied to the business that you're doing, where you're paying shareholders and all that type of stuff, intellectual property, and I don't know, set up a foundation. And for me, gain credibility that what you're building is something you think is more like a child or more like an entity. Otherwise, what I'm seeing is a lot of companies around the world where my personal opinion is that there is this welcome sense of a lack of clarity to not focus on the issues of hand of design and human computer interaction, like I mentioned, to avoid confusion and to add to disclosure, but to focus on issues that mainly sometimes are about guarding a bottom line, which that's not the goal in our work.
Good answer, I think, and one for us to think of, and at some future episode, I think the whole issue of potential machine consciousness will make an entire episode of Seeking Delphi. But for now, I thank you for this overview. Obviously, there's so much in there we could probably go on for hours, but I think hopefully it's piqued enough interest among our listeners to maybe do some investigating on their own. So I thank you for joining me and hope you'll keep us up to date on what's going on with this initiative in the future.
Well, thank you again, Mark, for dealing with my long answers. Enjoy, and for having me on the show again. And yeah, I would love to have more conversations on this because me, John, I'm mainly excited about learning. And then with our work overall, I would say for your listeners, please remember the book was written by hundreds of people, and then about 1,000 people also edited it. And the people that wrote it are really the people that I always try to say, the volunteers that wrote it. And you can see their names at the end of each chapter. The content I just think is magnificent. And so I really do hope that it's useful and helpful to your listeners, not necessarily the whole thing, but the sections that most apply to their work and their lives.
This ambitious work, with all the effort that went into it, is an important first step. Undoubtedly, there will be revisions and subsequent additions, but the most important facet of the work, the ultimate point of judgment, will be the extent to which the guidelines are actually adopted. If it's successful, it might well prove an effective model for ethical standards for other disruptive technologies, particularly those in biotechnology. My thanks again to John Havens for joining me and to you for listening. Be sure to subscribe to Seeking Delphi on iTunes, YouTube, or Player FM. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf, and until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.